Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Real Talk, a movie podcast. We are your go-to source for ratings and recommendations of past and present films. I am your host, Wes Jones, podcasting from Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Hey, this is Tommy, podcasting straight from Nashville, Tennessee.
The movie buddy Conway, podcasting from Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Here's Johnny!
What's up, Real Talk listeners? It's the best time of year. It's fall. It's October, or what I like to refer to as the Movie Buddy Torture Month. People are gearing up for Halloween, and that means horror films. And last year for October, we released three of our most popular episodes of our show. We kicked things off with 1978's Halloween, had literally the biggest Halloween fan in the world, Land of the Creeps host Greg Morgan, aka Greg Immortus, guest hosting on that episode. We followed it up by covering 1996's Scream with guest Jay of the Dead, Mr. Jason Piles from Horror Movie Weekly. We did an interview series episode with Leonora Sheffold, who played a small part in Scream. And then finally, we finished up the month and actually released an episode covering 1984's Ghostbusters on Halloween Day. It was a great month, and if you haven't heard any of those episodes, head into our archives now. Check those out. Okay, enough with the past. Let's get into the present. I'm so pumped for tonight as we're covering Stanley Kubrick's The Shining from 1980. And I had this inner struggle between Halloween and The Shining for my all-time favorite horror film. And I didn't even know if we were going to get to the episode tonight. We've had technical difficulties. We're running 30 minutes behind. All my co-hosts are mad at me, but at least they were able to talk about The Shining, the Simpsons Treehouse of Horror episode for a little while as I was trying to sort out these technical problems. So let's bring in our other mainstays, and I've said it for years, all work and no play make T-Man a dull boy. T-Man, you got to get out. You got to stop working so much. We don't want you to be a dull boy.
I know, man. I'll tell you what, I've been a dull boy all week because I've been watching The Shining on repeat. You know that face that Jack does when he's looking out the window? That's me. That's what I've been looking like all week. So just that dead face stare. That's what I look like right now. Getting out of bed, that's what I look like. And you're right, Wes. I've been watching The Shining all week. And actually, you conned me. You told me this episode was going to be about The Shining. The great, one of the great all-time classic Simpsons Treehouse of Horror segments. Why did you lie to me, man?
Well, ever since we've got to where we do our own episodes, we have to figure out unique ways to con the other ones to get on and start recording. And then, of course, we pull off the rug from one another and get into what we really want to cover. So just wait till I've been thinking hard about what can I do to get T-Man on a Cruel Intentions episode. Don't worry, I got it up my sleeve. It's coming soon.
I know you do. I know you do. Don't worry. That's the episode where everybody immediately logs off at the exact same time of the podcast. They're like, Cruel Intentions? Anyway, sorry.
Well, movie buddy, I know you've been dreading it all year, but it's time for Horror Movie Month. How you feeling?
I knew you were going to do this to me, Wes, you son of a bitch. I knew I was going to have to watch this movie again. I told you the story about me watching it as a child, and you tried to force me in college suites. You and T-Man strapped me to a chair and tried to make me watch The Shining, and I knew you were going to make me do it, and it's already happened again. On the real, guys, this does harken back to my days, and, you know, as I spent as an author writing my book out at an old woodland lodge with my family when no one could escape, and it was not a good story. The title of the book was All Work and No Play Makes Jack a Dull Boy. I took it to my publisher. You know, I told him I almost killed my whole family writing it. And he said it was a little repetitive, like this joke that me and Tommy do every episode.
Are you still doing this joke?
It's literally like 10 episodes in a row.
I was making a joke about doing the joke, but you cut me off, Tommy. I said, my editor said it was a little repetitive, like doing this joke every episode.
No, everybody knows. They knew that that was for real. Everybody in the audience was like, oh, man, it was barely funny the first time we did it.
Well, let's move on here. Let's get to tonight's guest. And he's making his second appearance on Real Talk. And last year he joined us as we covered four different Western films, and we had so much fun on that episode. This gentleman is a true legend in independent movie podcasting. He's been podcasting for many years, and you can most frequently catch him as a co-host on the excellent Land of the Creeps podcast, where he goes by Dr. Shock. He has a YouTube channel, Dave Dr. Shock Becker. He has an excellent website called DVDinfatuation.com, which we actually talked about last year on our episode we did with him. And speaking of DVD Infatuation, he now has his own podcast called the DVD Infatuation Podcast, and that's produced by Jason Piles, the guy that was on our Scream episode. Ladies and gentlemen, we present to you the Encyclopedia of Movie Knowledge, Mr. Dave Becker. Dave, welcome back. What's been going on, man?
Thank you, sir. And it's great to be back. I mean, I can't believe that Westerns episode I was looking it up, you know, on Skype. It tells you the last time that, you spoke with someone. It was July of last year. It does not seem like 15 months ago that we did that episode. But I had a blast. I had such a great time talking Westerns with you three gentlemen. It was so much fun. And when you asked me to come on with to talk about The Shining, I remember, over on HMP, we always sort of joked that we talked about The Shining like every third episode. And I'm thinking, wow, I've talked about that movie a lot. But then I hear that you had Greg Amortis on to talk Halloween. There's no way I could have talked The Shining more than Greg has talked Halloween in his podcasting career, and his goes back further than mine. I think he was podcasting a full year before I even started, and I'm sure he was talking Halloween from episode one, and I think he's pretty much said the word Halloween in every episode he's ever done since. So that's pretty impressive, and this is going to be great. I'm really, really looking forward to sort of diving into this movie even more than I have in the past for this time of year. It just works. And the way it starts, and we'll get into it, I'm sure. But the beautiful imagery and the sort of pounding, tense musical score as that helicopter is just flying over the terrain, it really just sets the perfect tone for this movie, that you're going to see something that in many ways is a work of art in the way that it's shot and the way that it's directed, but at the same time is just going to work on it's going to work on you. It's going to break you down, and it's going to terrify you at times.
And Dave, you know, that I was actually going to get to people's initial thoughts on The Shining, and you kicked that off really well. But one thing before we get too much further into The Shining, I did want to give you a quick opportunity to tell the audience a little bit what they can expect from your solo cast, DVDinfatuation.com, which I know you haven't been doing that very long, but tell the audience a little bit about it, where they can listen to it, and what to expect from it.
Absolutely. Thank you. Well, you can listen to it on Jay's Considering the Cinema site, and it's consideringthecinema.com. The DVD Infatuation podcast is sort of like, I guess, just a right. I don't have my own site for it. It is over on Jay's, and it's something I'm doing monthly. We actually did miss a month. Like I had recorded one. It's just going to be coming out pretty soon, actually, with Peter Nielsen of the Retro Movie Geek podcast. We talked Westerns. But over there, I just talk all genres, all type of movies. And it's very new experience for me, solo casting. I've never done it. Jay has been trying to get me to do it for years. Part of the reason I couldn't do it is the last time I edited audio was on a reel-to-reel tape deck in college. and I was just not looking forward to doing that. And everyone says, oh, it's not so long. It only takes usually 7-8 hours. I'm like, who the hell has a spare 7 and 8 hours, to be edited? I said, nah. So I was never interested. But Jay handles the production of it for me. He produces it. He edits it. And he said he would do that if I would record it. And I said, hey, yeah, I'll go for it then. And it's been so much fun. It's very unusual for me to be not only just the host, but the only one talking. Every show I had done up till that first episode of DVD Infatuation, I've been a co-host. I've not actually hosted a show ever before. So it's a very new experience, but it's also a lot of fun because I just get to talk about whatever I want to, whatever I happen to be sort of delving into at the moment. I mean, right before this Westerns one, my last episode that was posted, I looked at classic Hollywood. I had read a book called The Men Who Made the Movies, and it was interviews with like King Vidor and Raoul Walsh and William Wellman, all these old time directors. And I read that when I was on vacation, so I wanted to do an episode about old time Hollywood, and that's what I did in the previous one. So it's just been, it's been a lot of fun for years and years. I want to say almost a decade. It's been horror. That's been, you know, what I've been talking about. So it's kind of fun to branch out from there and talk about other genres, but horror is my favorite. And so when you offered me the chance to talk about The Shining, I absolutely jumped on it. First off, because it's been so long since I've talked with you, you three fine gentlemen, and I had such a blast the last time. I was looking forward to doing that again, but also just to talk about what really is one of the all-time great horror films from one of the all-time great filmmakers.
Well, Dave, you know, I've told you before several times just how much I respect your work and what you've done in indie podcasting. And again, Halloween is in The Shining. Those are probably my two most favorite horror films. They're both in my top 10 favorite films of all time. So I had to get Greg on for Halloween. And obviously, I was hoping you would say yes, because I really wanted you to get to do my other favorite horror film in The Shining. But I'll tell you this, next time you talk to Jay, I talk to him every now and then. I know he's unfortunately had a rough time lately. But yeah, one other little kind of podcasting check mark I'd like to do is I would love to have both you and Jay on an episode together sometime. That would just be awesome. I don't even care what the subject is. We can do whatever, but I'd love to have you both come on sometime.
I would be there. I would absolutely do it. Jay is one of my oldest and closest friends. He really is. I was so happy I got a chance to meet him back in 2017 at the meetup in Utah. I would jump at that opportunity. And actually, it's funny you mentioned that, because tomorrow we are recording for DVD Infatuation, the October episode, and my guest will be Jay of the Dead. So we're going to be podcasting for the first time together, talking horror in a couple years, since he had stepped down at Horror Movie Podcast. It's been a couple years since we talked horror, and we're going to get a chance to do that again tomorrow. But thank you very much for the kind words. And like I said, it's just so much fun to be talking with y'all again. And to talk about a movie like this is just, it's great. It's absolutely great.
Well, I appreciate that. And we will definitely be tuned in for that October episode of DVD Infatuation. And audience, I definitely encourage you to go and check that episode out as well. And again, audience, tonight we're covering The Shining. We're going to be talking about a bunch of different aspects and theories from the film. I don't even think I need to, but I'm going to go ahead and give a spoiler warning now. We're going to spoil everything. We're even going to do a segment on the ending. So if you haven't seen The Shining, shame on you. Take care of that now and then come back and enjoy the rest of the episode. And so, like I had said, I was going to ask everybody for their initial thoughts. So, Dave, do you have any additional thoughts, initial thoughts on The Shining before we go around table and get everybody else's?
I guess it really just comes down to, for me, it's Stanley Kubrick. You know, I've been such a fan of his for such a long time. And oddly enough, I think The Shining might have been the first Stanley Kubrick film I ever saw. My family got cable back in 1981. I remember waking up at about 2 o'clock in the morning and sneaking into the room upstairs, right down the hall from my bedroom, and turning on The Shining 2 a.m. And I had to wake up for school the next day. I actually watched The Shining, then I had to wake up and go to school. I would have probably been in seventh grade, I guess, at the time, just to see the movie. And of course, it worked on me in a big way. I mean, there were scenes in it that were just absolutely shocking. You know, for a kid that age, I was glad there was some nudity in it, let's be honest. The movie just really, it did. It scared the hell out of me. And then having to go into school first off being tired from waking up at 2 a.m., but then having seen The Shining. I did that a couple times. The only other one, it's one I actually just talked about with Retro Movie Geek, was Conan the Barbarian. I woke up real early just so I could watch that one as well. But The Shining was the first one. It's the first Kubrick film I'm pretty sure that I saw. I was aware of Kubrick as a filmmaker because I was, you know, buying books and whatnot and just learning about movies. But The Shining was the first Kubrick film that I ever saw. And it's a masterwork. I think every Kubrick film has that. And, you know, he is a director who likes to do a lot of takes. You know, when, like, I think there's a, he did, in this movie, there's a record where he did like over 100 takes of a single scene.
It's the baseball bat scene.
The baseball bat scene, yes. And it's funny because I read a quote with Kubrick where he said that usually Jack's later takes are better than his earlier takes. I don't know how the hell you can go through 100 takes and pick out which one is the best out of 100 takes. I mean, you have to come away. You probably have to whittle it down to the top 30 and then get it down to the top 15 or something like that. But that's one of the things you take away from Kubrick. It almost has like, it's almost like with Orson Welles, where he just has that eye and that sort of sense of perfection. Like you're watching perfection when you're watching a Kubrick film, and it's all very artistic. You get the feeling that no shot, no image is a mistake, is not meant to be there. And that's in any movie he's made. You know, going back to Killer's Kiss, which is probably the first, well, I think he did Fear and Desire, but he pulled that out. He didn't release it. He wasn't happy with that. So Killer's Kiss, I think, was like the first film of his that really got out there to the public. You see that in all of his movies. And it's really something. And that's what I take away from it. Just the perfection, just the skill that went into making this horror film that even with its artistic bent still can unnerve you, still scares you.
Well, T-Man, I don't know how you're going to follow that up, but let's kick it over to you and see what you got for your initial thoughts on The Shining.
Well, guys, here's the thing. Sometimes in life, you've just got to kind of make a call. You know, I came on thinking, all right, what am I going to do with this movie? Because I have some opinions that just do not track with the majority, I guess you got to say. And Wes, I know it's your favorite film of all time or one of your favorites. I don't want to be too harsh on it, so I know you've been really looking forward to this movie in this episode. So I'm not going to go too hard, but I'll just be honest. I think I've always thought that The Shining's overrated. I don't love it. I don't think I ever have, really. And this last viewing kind of solidified that for me. There's just something about it that I think is kind of, it's a little fake to me. It's artificial. It doesn't seem real. And I know Stanley Kubrick, some of his movies can feel that way. Like, you know, he made what's his Vietnam movie? I can't even think. Full Metal Jacket. You know, he shot a Vietnam movie in England. So a lot of his movies feel that way, and sometimes it's on purpose. But this one, for some reason, just feels artificial, like overly artificial to me. Also, Jack's performance, we're going to talk about that. It's not even on the verge of parody at this point. It is just a parody. Like, he is basically just doing a parody of that performance, in my opinion. Like, it's not scary. I don't think he's scary at all. Like, I was texting you guys today. I don't think the movie is, like, scary at all. Another thing is, I think the another problem that I have with it is I missed it when it came out, like you were saying, Dave. And because of that, and because the movie got so ingrained in the culture, and we were talking about The Shining, which is one of the all-time great Simpsons episodes, when I finally watched The Shining, it was almost like I'd already watched it, and I was, you know, you'd heard so much about it, how great it was, and I was just kind of let down. I've never loved it. I know it's always on lists that, like, rank it so high, but there are lots of horror movies that I prefer over this one. All that said, it's still good. It's just not to the point of as great as a lot of people think, in my opinion. So, like I said, lots more to come, Wes. By the end of this episode, Wes is going to be like Jack, coming after me in the snow. I'm going to be that little kid, but I'll be retracing my steps. I got ahead of him on it.
Definitely some hot takes in there. But before we get too much into that, Gabe, initial thoughts on The Shining?
I love that T-Man's coming out firing a cannon on this. Dave and Wes were a little quiet. They don't know what to say, but I like that. Tommy's brave. My initial thoughts, this is a story that I've told Tommy and Wes a bunch of times. When I was a child, my parents told me not to watch this movie because mom and dad were watching a scary movie. I was way too young. I probably was, I don't know, somewhere between 6 and 9. I'm bad at years. But I stood, like, we had this couch and we had this end table. And I, like, sat under the end table and I watched The Shining. And it was at, I was part of when Jack was flipping out. And, you know, as a kid, you know, dads were a safe place. Well, I saw that dads could flip out and murder their whole families, or at least attempt to. And it changed everything for me. So I was, I slept with a bat for like a month. I was really horrified. And that's why this movie was scary to me, is because I watched it at such a young age. It had horror nostalgia for me. I don't know. Are there any movies like that for you guys that you watched at a young age that just scared you?
Oh yeah. For me, when I was a lot younger, I remember watching Westworld and being kind of freaked out by that. I remember watching The Birds, Alfred Hitchcock, The Birds, which affected me. So absolutely. I mean, even like I said, when we got cable, I was around 10 years old. And you know, in my preteen years, watching movies like The Fun House, Friday the 13th, and a lot of those movies. Yeah, absolutely. There are movies that just sort of stay with you and scare you when you're a child. So it really matters, I think. For a lot of horror films, it's like, some, when do you see it? When is do you see it in your formative years? Do you see it later? As to whether it becomes like ingrained, whether it becomes a favorite or not. And you know, as Tommy had mentioned, he saw it later. He didn't get to see the movie early on. And you know, I'm not saying he would have loved it if he saw it earlier. He may have had the exact same opinion. But it's just very interesting how some things, and maybe it is nostalgia. Maybe there have been a lot of times, you know, something like, you know, with the slashers of the 80s, they're not, some of them are not well-made movies, you know. And I remember Matt Rawlings over in Father and Son Watch Horror Movies making that point at one point. The slashers are not great movies, but when you see them when you are when you're younger, it just becomes a nostalgia and you just fall in love with the films. So, yeah, I definitely think that, you know, seeing them at a young age is can definitely have a color your opinion on a film. So absolutely.
Westy, is there a young, scary movie that scared super scary movie fan Wes Jones?
Well, one of the first horror films that I ever watched beginning to end was Halloween 4, which I think is one of the reasons why I became such a big Halloween fan, because it I don't know how old I was. I believe that movie came out in 88. I was 6 whenever it came out. It was probably a few years later, maybe 4 or 5 years after it came out, that I saw it. And it scared me to death. I had to sleep on the floor of my parents' bedroom. And I've always, through the years, just looked back at that film. And I love it because of that. It's not a great movie by any stretch, but it is a solid, it's a fun movie, and that's definitely one that sticks out in my mind.
Blair Witch Project I thought was really scary, but I was a little older. I was in my teens by that point, so I can't think of anything like, oh, I tell you what, I know what it is. Ghostbusters 2. That movie as a kid, remember that scene with the like babysitter ghost outside the window and reaches in for the baby? Now that's scary.
Oh, you know what? You just reminded me of when you said outside the window. I think I might have been 12 years old when I saw Salem's Lot for the first time, with that little kid floating outside the window, scratching on the window, the vampiric little kid.
Oh, yeah, that's a super scary scene.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Tommy acts all tough on the podcast, but he called me after Paranormal Activity. And asked if I was coming home, and it slept with a dog. Hates dogs. So, you know, you can.
First of all, I don't hate dogs. Don't put it out there that I hate dogs.
Yeah, that's an unpopular opinion. I'm sorry about that.
I'm already gonna be on people's bad list with the Shining reactions tonight.
So I've got to get it all out there tonight, Tommy.
I do want to just mention, you mentioned about Jack Nicholson going over the top. One of the things that I had mentioned, sent a message to Wes about this. I was reading a book that I've owned for about 20 years, and I've only ever like leafed through before, but now I actually broke it open because it worked for this episode. It's called Stanley Kubrick Director of Visual Analysis. And it's from, I think it came out in 1999 or 2000. It does have Eyes Wide Shut in it. And it was written by Alexander Walker, Sybil Taylor, and Ulrich Ruppti. And it has entire chapters dedicated to each of his movies, and The Shining is one of them. And it makes a point in this film about Jack Nicholson's performance, how a lot of critics thought he went, he was too much. He went over the top. But as the character builds, as he slowly loses his mind, the book says at one point, over the top was all he had left. There was nowhere else for that character to go but over the top.
Right. And I think I'm sure we will, but I think you're exactly right. And that's one of the reasons why Stephen King hated the movie. And honestly, critics were pretty divided on it when it came out. Like it was not a critical success.
Yeah.
Right. It didn't get reappraised. You know, always laughed that I think we've laughed about this. Roger Ebert did one of his famous, you know, he didn't give it a good review the first time, but then like 20 years later, he's like, you know what? Never mind. Everybody likes it now. Let me put it in my great movies book.
He did that with a few. He wasn't all that big on Blade Runner initially either, but that ended up making his great movies as well. I remember that one also. But you know, it's funny. You're in good company, actually, Tommy, because someone else who thought wasn't initially impressed with Jack Nicholson's performance. And I'm not sure if it was in the Stanley Kubrick documentary in pictures or where it was, but I remember Steven Spielberg when he first was talking with Kubrick. Kubrick asked him what he thought of The Shining, and Spielberg was sort of hemming and hawing. Oh, you know, I like this, and Kubrick picked up on it immediately. Goes, it sounds to me, Steven, like you didn't like my movie. And Spielberg said, well, I thought Nicholson went over the top. I thought he went too over the top in his performance. And then Kubrick did something very interesting. He asked Spielberg to name his five favorite actors. Spielberg had said Cary Grant, Spencer Tracy. I'm not sure who he mentioned. But Kubrick says, I noticed you didn't say James Cagney in there. And, you know, and Spielberg goes, no, I didn't. Cagney would be up there. You know, he definitely is a good actor. And Kubrick said, I think if you are a fan of James Cagney, you would understand Nicholson's performance a little bit more. And I think he might be referring to some of Cagney, when he would play the gangsters, he had a tendency to become flamboyant, especially White Heat. He did some scenes in that you could sort of see as over the top. Yet Cagney is considered a great actor, and that was a great performance in White Heat. It really was. It's a terrific performance. And he sort of equated Jack Nicholson to James Cagney. And Kubrick was blown away by what Nicholson was doing. And I'm just going to go to the book, if you can just give me a minute here real quick. There's the scene where he's having the interview with, you know, the manager of the hotel. And there's a scene where the manager of the hotel is talking to him. Are you going to be okay being secluded here? And he says to him, how will your wife and son be? How will your family be in the seclusion? And Jack Nicholson said, the character, Jack Torrance, says, oh, they'll love it. And Kubrick was talking about that scene. He goes, look at Jack's eyes. Look at Nicholson's eyes when he says that. He's saying, oh, they'll love it. But when you look at his eyes, he's thinking, what the hell? What the hell do they matter? Why are you even asking me about them? They don't matter. And that's an interesting thing about this character. Wendy is a loving mother. You never get the feeling in this movie that Jack is a loving father or even a caring husband or father. He seems detached. He seems a bit aloof throughout this. And I don't know if that was in the initial intention or if that was Nicholson's performance, but Kubrick ran with it. He took what Nicholson was doing and would actually rewrite scenes based on what Nicholson was giving him in this movie to change things around a little bit. And that's one of the reasons why Stephen King didn't like it, is it changed his story so much. It became less a Stephen King story and more a Stanley Kubrick movie as it went along. And it was Nicholson's performance that was sort of driving him to make those changes.
I agree with you, Dave. And one thing that, you know, and I understand like the Stephen King thing, because Stephen King wanted to be more subtle. He wanted it to be, hey, this is somebody you can relate to, and then eventually they go crazy because Nicholson
was
never
what was in the book. Yeah.
Yeah. Nicholson was never somebody you could relate to. In fact, when I was watching it, I was like, there's the whole scene in the car. I was like, hold on.
He's crazy from the get-go.
Yeah, I was like, he's creeping me out. He's like,
yeah, he's not even friend. Oh, he learned it on the television, you know.
Jack. Well, it took Jack beating his child to quit drinking. There's your son, and he goes, I'm hungry. The little kid's in the car. He says, I'm hungry. He's like, well, you should have eaten this morning when I told you to. And then he follows it up with a story of cannibalism. Right. So it's like, Jack, I was like, man, this guy should have never been a father. Like, I have a six-year-old. Like, I would never talk about that stuff. But I want to finish my initial thought, and I know that I asked a bunch of questions, so it went a different ways. Tommy, I completely disagree with you. Because The Shining accomplished, even though I was afraid of it as a kid, it accomplished what it's supposed to do for me. And I think it's a near perfect horror movie because of two things, the tone and the cinematography. Like, there's not a movie horror movie I've ever watched that puts this in, I don't know, the tone. It's like the rest of my day, I feel like I'm just kind of shot because I watched The Shining, because it's just like, it's horrific. Like, no movie, like, makes me just feel ill. Like, I don't know.
It's heavy, Gabe. It's like you wear it around afterwards.
Like, every time I watch The Shining.
I don't get that feeling. I don't get it like that. Like, I've watched it multiple times, and I'm just like, well, okay. That was pretty good.
I don't disagree with T-Man much, and I guess I could see that point, but it's just like, this movie is like a near-perfect horror movie to me because of
Here's my real thoughts. Just real quick, here's my real thoughts on The Shining. I think it's well made, and I think people have gotten into kind of a groupthink on it, which happens in a lot of times, and it's become like something that people have to say is great, even though I don't know if everybody truly thinks that. A lot of movies, when people are like, it's great, I totally get it, but The Shining is one I'm just like, I just don't see it.
I mean, from the time you hear the opening music to seeing the Jack in the picture at the end, I'm enthralled. You know, quite simply, I think The Shining is a true masterpiece. And I had this thought long ago, and during my most recent viewing of The Shining, more than ever before, I paid attention to all the technical aspects of the film, because I had this thought that, man, I think this might be the best directed and best shot film of all time. And I'm like, I'm really going to pay attention to that. And honestly, when I was looking at the movie more technically this time, I was honestly in awe of the shots and the angles, the framing and the production design of the hotel and everything. And as the night unfolds, we'll continue to get into more of my thoughts. But when I think about The Shining, that's what I think about first now, is the technical achievement. And more like one more thought here, I can't really think of another horror film that is shot or where they've even tried to imitate The Shining. I don't know. Like, there are newer films that kind of evoke the spirit of The Shining in a few scenes, like Hereditary or The Witch, but it's just for certain scenes. And that's another thing I thought about. I was like, I've never even really seen another horror movie that's really attempted to even look like The Shining.
I agree with you 100%. It is masterfully shot. I mean, you had the Steadicam operator, the guy who invented the Steadicam, was on this. And the scenes where he's, where Danny is pedaling, you know, that big wheel around the hotel. You have, you know, he had the Steadicam actually down by his knee, and he was following him almost at like Danny's level as he's going through. And just the rhythm of that, you can tell when he's on the carpet and when he's on the wood. Yeah. You hear the like, you know, so the sound in that and the way that it's shot and the way he's going around, that he's just sort of playing. And then the sequence where he sees those two little girls, that terrified me. When I was younger, that scene terrified me. One of the things that really gets me are ghosts. Ghosts absolutely scare me. I don't know if it's my Catholic upbringing. You know, I went 12 years of Catholic school. I don't know what it, but ghosts always terrify me. And that scene where he sees them at the end of the hall, and then they're saying, come play with us, Danny, forever. You know, that scared the hell out of me. And he shut his eyes. And I'm thinking, my God, if he opens his eyes and they're like all of a sudden on top of him, that would, you know, I, as a kid, that I was just terrified by that. And if you look at the way that Kubrick shot those two little girls, you know, he has them standing there, and the way they move in unison. This book they're referring to, I mean, this book that I'm reading says they're almost like they're hinged together and they have to move together. And that's that sort of movement is in itself enough sort of uncanny and enough to put you on edge for these two little girls, is that they always move together. They turn on their heels as if they're joined at the hip, as if they're Siamese twins, or I guess that's not politically correct, conjoined twins. And they turn and walk that way. It's very unsettling. And you only see them a couple times. They're not through them, you know, you don't see them much throughout the movie, but when you do see them, it's very effective.
Let's get into, I guess, our, that was really supposed to be initial thoughts, but we got into a bunch of really good stuff, and T-Man was able to air his dirty laundry there as well. So let's get into.
I got much more, guys. People are going to hate me by the end of this episode, but that's okay.
Let's talk about a little about Stephen King's book and then extrasensory perception. So The Shining is the third book from author Stephen King. And after writing Carrie and Salem's Lot, he wanted to do something a little bit different. And he planned to spend a year away from Maine, where he lived, collecting, in his words, new experiences. So he would have a different background for his next book. So on October 30th of 1974, he and his wife checked into the Stanley Hotel in Estes Park, Colorado, hotel built in 1909, and it actually remains open today. It was a large hotel, but on that particular night, King said that they were the only two guests in the entire hotel. And to make a long story short, King stayed up drinking at the bar, being served by a bartender named Grady. And I'll read you a quote directly from King. He said, "That night I dreamed my three-year-old son running through corridors, looking back over his shoulder, eyes wide, screaming. He was being chased by a fire hose. I woke up with a tremendous jerk, sweating all over, within an inch of falling off the bed. I got up, lit a cigarette, sat in a chair looking out the window at the Rockies, and by the time my cigarette was done, I had the bones of the book firmly set into my mind." From this quote, I think we can see how the story and book started to come together. So have any of you guys actually read the novel?
I haven't.
No, I have not read the novel either.
I have not read the novel, but I have, for what it's worth, looked up the hotel that he stayed at, and it looks creepy.
What?
That you know what? It's that
hotel. How's that?
It's a side note.
That's not even close. That's like saying, like, what? I should have just said, yes, Wes, I've read a book.
I haven't read the novel. I read a book. I haven't, you know, I haven't walked to school. I rode the school bus once. No, but it's a point. It's something Wes was talking about. It's kind of like reading a book.
Right. Gabe's done a lot of research. He knows the periphery stuff for sure.
Well, King, he did something interesting within the framework of his story. You know, he had the dream, and then he took this idea of extrasensory perception, or it's commonly referred to as ESP, which, of course, in the story, they referred to it as shining, or someone who shines. And it added such a great layer to the story and ultimately how it plays out. And after looking up ESP, I found in the 1930s, J.B. Ryan began a study on ESP. And that term was coined to denote psychic abilities, intuition, telepathy, clairvoyance, which of course is still a little taboo in our society, referred to as black magic sometimes. People in the scientific community, of course, denounce ESP because there's no viable theory to explain the mechanism behind it. So science also can't really explain dreams, so there isn't always a scientific explanation for why things happen. So you guys tell me, I was curious. I was like, do you guys believe in people having extrasensory perception or a sixth sense?
I do, to a point. I myself have experienced it, and it's funny because I experienced it in much the same way that my father did. at one point. My father was a Vietnam veteran, and he was over in Vietnam, and he woke up in the middle of the night at one point and said, my grandmother just died. And he went into, the radio room, and he was trying to make a call back to Philadelphia to check on his grandmother. At the same time, his aunt was calling out to Vietnam, so they crossed to tell my father that his grandmother had just died. I experienced the exact same thing. It was in November of 1975. I remember I'm laying on the couch. I was 6 years old. I'm laying on a couch and I'm watching the Little Rascals on TV. I got this blanket on me and I say to myself, my grandmother just died. Not 3 seconds later, the phone rings. My mother answers and starts to cry. It was her mother, and says, your grandmother just passed away, and sends us up to the neighbors. So I think there's something to it. I do. I really do. I think that, to a degree, there's something that's, and I can't explain it. I don't know why those things happen. It's one of those things that's very strange. I don't know why. I've never had it again in my life. And I don't know if my father ever had it again in his life, other than referring to our maternal grandmothers and the moment they passed away, that we were able to, that we knew it before actually learning about it. But yeah, I think there might be something to it.
I'll tell you real quick, Wes, that conversation that Danny has with the chef is the turning point in The Shining, talking about The Shining. I mean, it's just so... It's my favorite scene in the whole movie, but I'm going to agree with Dave. There's been a couple times in my life where I just knew something bad happened, and then something bad, and it was always something serious and something bad would happen. It's like I got this feeling in my bones, and it's happened to me a couple times. And then my grandmother had a twin, and she could always tell, when something was going on with the, and they were identical twins, so they could always tell if something good or something bad happened, and they swore by it for years, and they would always tell me about it. Now, Rachel is a little bit on the far end of the stick with that. She believes that the dog can tell what she's thinking, and I don't believe her at all. But she believes that the dog knows what she's thinking. So, well, I'll let her have it.
Team, any thoughts on that? I'm kind of with these guys. I don't think that it's I don't think that it's where people can be psychics and stuff like that. But there is something weird about this extrasensory perception. I think a lot of people seem to kind of experience and get bad feelings that turn out to be true.
Well, don't they say that, we're only using 10% of our brains or something? I mean, there's so much power within our brains that we're not using that. I think it is very possible that there are some people that maybe have heightened versions of that, or something's going on. You guys ever seen that movie Scanners, where they're blowing people's heads up? That's a possibility. I could see that happening for sure. If there was a power, that's what I want. I don't know. I think it's definitely a possibility to the point of The Shining. No, I don't really believe that. But is there something else going on sometimes that is under the radar or just outside of our realm of understanding? I think that's perfectly possible. We only know what we know. We only know what we see. We, touch, taste, smell, whatever it is. Who knows what else is going on?
I think that Tommy acknowledges that. I think that's what makes The Shining so creepy, is that we all believe that could exist. Not all of us may believe that ghosts could exist, but all of us slightly believe that could exist.
Or at least that there are people out there who have that sort of perception. That heightened sense, and as much as we could sit here and think, wow, that's pretty cool, we see that it could be just as much of a curse for these people as opposed to a superpower.
Well, Dave, have you seen, Dr. Sleep, the sequel? I don't know if we're going to talk about that.
Yes, I have seen Dr. Sleep, and I watched it again tonight. I do, too. Yeah. I love Dr. Sleep. I think it's a great follow-up.
It shows, I think it goes to what you're talking about, is that it does show the repercussions and the after effects and really the post-traumatic that Danny goes through and people with The Shine goes through, because it would be horrific, really. Honestly, at the end of the day, you're seeing ghosts and people trying to kill you all the time. That would have awful effect.
Absolutely. my mother came in while I was laying in bed one time with this rose around my neck. She said, you can't wear that. You might strangle yourself in the night. And I told her, I said, well, look, I saw The Exorcist and it really scared me. I want to have this. It makes me feel comfortable. You know, it makes me feel like I'll be safe. And my mother sat on my bed and she had a talk with me and she was being very physical. Look, if you're a good person, you know, the devil won't possess you. You'll be okay. You don't have to worry about it. I didn't have the heart to tell her, I'm not worried about the devil right. possessing me. I'm worried about the devil possessing you. Because then, if he possesses right. you, I'm the one getting picked up and spewed on and thrown out the goddamn window. I'm not worried. If he's possessing me, I'm not going to remember it later on. I'm worried about matter. Everybody else around me. I want to keep you all away from me.
Listeners, for an upcoming episode of the show, we're going to be covering Scarefest 13, set to take place on October 22nd through the 24th in Lexington, Kentucky. In preparation, we sat down with media director for Scarefest, Wes Forsyth, and I wanted to play this clip from our conversation. For those of you who may be interested in attending this year's event and joining Real Talk, I think this provided some great insight.
Give us your pitch for people who've never been before, first timers. What can they expect from this year's event and the reason we all need to head to Lexington on Friday, October 22nd to spend the weekend with you guys?
Well, I can say to anybody, and this is whether you've been to a horror and or a Paracon, if you've been to a horror convention or not, you've never been to anything like the Scarefest. Most conventions are just set up where you go in, you meet the stars, you do a little shopping, you go home. You know, you buy an autograph or two. You might pick up a machete or whatever. Scarefest does things a lot differently. And we reflected on our website, thescarefest.com. We actually build an event around the convention. So you've got the convention, and then you've got all these other things going on. We've got movie premieres this year. We've got some classic horror movies showing at the Lex Live Theaters that you don't get to see on the big screen. So if you're a movie fan, Weird Science, my God, how long has it been since that's been in the theater? We've got it. The Toxic Avenger. And of course, these will all be introduced by cast members that are attending our convention. Of course, we have the typical seminars and panels like other conventions, but then we actually have entertainment on the floor of the convention. So if you just want to take a break and go actually watch something fun and interesting, we've got people coming in to do the Thriller Dance, for example, which is a big part of the Lexington Downtown Halloween celebration. But we've got aerialist. We actually have acrobats that will be performing on the Scarefest floor. We have two events that we've added this year. Well, we added one a couple years ago as a test run, but we actually have stuff like, okay, you go to any convention in America and tell me where you can go throw axes with movie stars. We've got it set up where you can actually go to Battle Axes of Lexington, get on a team with one of our stars, Kane Hodder, Ari Mihailov, Robert Mukes, or we'll have teams, and you spend an hour throwing axes with people that in the movies throw axes. It's just unbelievable time. We've got Linnea Quigley coming this year, and of course she's was famous for Sorority Babes at the Slime Ball Bowlerama. Well, we decided since we have a bowling alley across the street, we created Scream Queens at the Lex Live Bowlerama, and now you can actually join a team and bowl with famous Scream Queens. That is just something that other conventions do not do.
Well, let's bring the 1980 The Shining movie into the fold here. And I want to start with this quote.
That's right. That's what we're talking about.
Yes.
Right. I want to start with this quote by Stanley Kubrick, because back in the late 70s, Warner Brothers sent Kubrick a copy of the manuscript for his review. And after reading it, he said, I thought it was one of the most ingenious and exciting stories of the genre I'd ever read. It seemed to strike an extraordinary balance between the psychological and the supernatural in a way as such to lead you to think that the supernatural would eventually be explained by the psychology. Jack must be imagining these things because he's crazy. And this allowed you to suspend your doubt of the supernatural until you were so thoroughly into the story that you could almost accept it without noticing. And I found it interesting that Kubrick had such great things to say about King's book and the manuscript that he had read. But as we've already alluded to just a little bit, when the film came out, King was highly critical of it. He went so far to adapt a miniseries of the same name in the late 90s, basically to correct, quote unquote, what Kubrick got wrong.
Yeah, that miniseries. That's my stuff right there, Wes. I love that miniseries. It's got the Wings guy. You know, the guy from Wings is in it.
Well, I was going to say real quick, so we don't get on like a tangent about miniseries. Has anybody ever seen the miniseries?
Heck yeah. I love that miniseries.
You know, no. I haven't seen it. I know Kubrick. I know King is much more, I guess, he connects. He looks at that one as more as of a genuine adaptation of his work. Yes.
Yeah.
He so, looks at that quick, one. So yes.
I saw it. And so here's my story on that. And honestly, it probably has affected my viewing of the movie, The Shining, actually, is I watched that version first. Of course, I saw The Shining, then I watched that version because I was a kid, and that was a big ABC miniseries. Stephen King was, like, he wrote the screenplay, I think, for it. He was, like, really involved with it because he bought the rights back from Kubrick. From my understanding, he bought the rights back from Kubrick, and the deal was, I don't know if you guys know this, the deal was Kubrick could no longer bash the movie version from 1980 if Kubrick would sign him over the deal, like the rights to it.
You mean King could no longer bash?
Yeah, King could no longer bash the 1980 version because he'd been doing that for years. But Kubrick said in the deal that he could continue to bash Jack Nicholson's performance, which is actually funny. So the miniseries, in my opinion, so when I saw it as a kid, it was scary, like, as a kid, and I really liked it. But it's very, like, I don't think it holds up. Like, if we watched it now, it would have that TV miniseries feel from the 90s. But when I watched it then, I really liked it. But I think that also played effect of me when I watched the Shining for the first time. I had the miniseries lens in my mind also. Because I think that is a truer representation of the book. Because I think the big thing that King does not like, two big things, and I'm sure you know this, Wes, and a lot of the big Shining fans know this, is that Jack Nicholson starts out too crazy. You know, King's book is the character is normal. The hotel haunts him to turns into this murderous person. And then King also did not like how Shelley Duvall was not as not strong enough. The character was stronger in the book. So anyway, just want to digress on that. Have seen the miniseries and liked it when it first came out.
I think it's one of the Shelley Duvall is a very interesting character in this film because you get the feeling right from the start that Jack Torrance does not have any respect for his wife. Mm-mm. He doesn't look at her as an equal. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't, he sort of looks at her as this goofy character. I mean, when they're taking that tour of the hotel and Wendy is just sort of gushing, oh, it's the most beautiful place I've ever seen. It's great. And she does that little dance when they go into the gold room and everything. You get the feeling that Jack is embarrassed by her in a way. And that might be Nicholson's performance, you know, again, where he's not the Jack Torrance of the book, where he's normal at first. He's a normal family man who sort of, you know, becomes possessed by this hotel. He is, he's sort of a tortured soul at the beginning. He has his demons at the beginning, and you see them. You know, Nicholson doesn't hide them in his performance. You see the demons of Jack coming out in the very opening scenes with him, even when he calls home. You know, it's like, oh, so I guess she got the job. Yeah. You know, he's just sort of distanced. Like, there's no sort of respect for his wife. And no real love for his son, so it definitely makes his transition. You know, he goes from being this detached character to being insane. You know, in the book, the one with the guy from Wings, Steven Weber. He goes from a family man to being possessed by the hotel and going after his family. In the Kubrick version, you have someone who doesn't really feel an attachment to his family, then going to the point that he's going to kill them. You know, going against his nature, even though he doesn't have any respect for his wife or connection with his child, he's still going against his nature to kill them. And that's where Nicholson goes over the top. I mean, you look at it with that, the whole scene, not by the hair of my chinny chin chin, then I'll
yeah, huff, it's like a comedy
and
at that
I'll
point.
Huff. Yeah. But it's like I said, this book makes the point. That's the only place he could go was over the top, because right. He doesn't start from a position of a loving husband and father in this. You never get the feeling that he's either of those things from the opening, from the first scene where he's interacting with his wife. You never get the feeling he has any respect for her.
Over the years, and we're weaving in and out of some of this stuff, but a lot's been made of the differences between the book and the film, because both are extremely popular with a passionate fan base. And so there's a couple of key differences between the book and the movie. So the main difference is the one that T-Man and Dave has brought up, and it's the one that King was so hung up on, you know, the more gradual mental decline of Jack in the book. He actually has a lot of inner dialogue while he's going through this decline. You know, he's the normal guy that the hotel slowly turns very menacing. It was also brought up that Wendy is a strong character in the book and one who puts together kind of what's happening with the Overlook Hotel. In the book, Danny's ESP plays a larger part and it impacts the story more. We get more about the Overlook's history, which makes the hotel more of a character in the book. A couple more differences. At the end, instead of the maze, we've got the hedge animals coming to life and hurting people. The Overlook gets inside Jack so much that he wants to become part of the staff and work his way up into management. Tony and Danny, you know, Tony's his imaginary friend. They meet in an alternate Overlook universe, and he gets pertinent information about saving his family. You know, in the movie, Tony's doesn't play much of a role. And then finally, the Overlook explodes, like, at the end of the book. So the reason I read those differences is, number one, just for the audience who've never read the book or who don't know the differences between The Shining and the movie. But I wanted to ask you guys, is there anything from the book that didn't make it into Kubrick's film that you thought would have enhanced Kubrick's film?
Easy. Hedge mages coming to life, man.
You know, it's funny.
Coming to
that's,
life.
That's the one. That's the one I'm glad he didn't do. I didn't want to see that at all.
Because, well, I'll say this: that I remember that from the miniseries, and like, of course, you got 1990s TV special effects. Even then, I was like, "All right, this is not working." That was good. they did not put that in there at all. I don't know. That's a good question.
I want the hotel to explode. Like, on top of everything that else has happened, just explode that hotel.
You know, that would have been, I mean, you kind of get that in Dr. Sleep.
Yeah, they burst them.
You kind of put that in at the end of Dr. Sleep. you get the hotel sort of blowing up at that point. But yeah, that would have been kind of cool. That might have been a little bit cool. I'll go with you.
They kind of merged those innings. That's what I read, that Mike Flanagan, the director of Dr. Sleep, had to merge those two plot lines because he was kind of doing a mixture of the books and the movies. So I do like that aspect. I thought that I would agree. I think that would be a good, they needed probably that also.
Yeah. And it's very funny because one of the things when Kubrick finally saw Dr. Sleep, he did make the comment that it made him appreciate Kubrick's Shining a little bit more. You know, he sort of, that was his first, admission that, you know, that there might have been some merit in Kubrick's version of The Shining. When he saw Dr. Sleep, he said, right, that made me appreciate the original 1980 The Shining a little bit more.
Well, the one thing that I think I would have liked to have seen in the movie a little bit more is this character of Tony, because I think there are aspects of the ESP in the Shining movie, but there's just not a whole lot of it. And looking back on it this last time, I was like, man, they could have really dove into that a little bit more, especially because the movie's called The Shining. So yes, I would have loved to have seen some of that stuff that was in the book.
I never really understand even like what Tony is or who he is or like what's going on there, and the voice and the finger. I've never liked that subplot or like that aspect. I don't think they hit that on the mark like you're saying, Wes.
Oh, I think they did. Like, Tony creeps me out because little kids say this off the wall stuff. Like, tonight I was putting my kid to bed and she goes, you know, I like this house, but I like our other house better. I was like, we only have one house. What are you talking about? You know, our house in Russia. I go, our house at the beach, because I was talking about my parents' house. She goes, no, our house in Russia.
What? Oh, man, nice. You got a house in Russia, Gabe?
What house
Whoa.
In Russia? She goes,
holy cow, 30. That is something.
She doesn't know, like, what Russia is. She goes, you know, the one with the snow, you know, from our other life. And I was like,
what?
What are you talking
about? Let me tell
about?
You something. Let me tell you something. I'm, you know what? And I don't mean to creep you out there, Gabe. But one of the things, I remember seeing this, that there are children. There are children who remember past lives. And they can pick up on that. There was a that kid when he was 4 years old who remembered being a pilot in World War II for Germany and being shot down in England. And he remembered the town. He described the town, and the mother did research and found out that there was a pilot shot down in that town. He ended up dying there, and that her child remembered every aspect of it. So you know what? I'm not trying to creep you out, dude. That is, you just saying that now. Right there, man. That
is Eva. Eva's shining. It sounds like.
Yeah,
she's shining.
Maybe,
yeah,
maybe a little bit. It's funny how in the sequel, Dr. Sleep, you get more of The Shining than you do in the actual Shining. You really do.
You really shocked me a little bit there, Dave, because now I'm a little bit more creeped out than I was about the previous conversation. But what I was going to say is, like, every dad, like, has a story about little things. I mean, I wasn't really that creeped out by that. But there's been some little things, like Jack talks in his sleep. So that little finger thing, like, and he said weird stuff in his sleep sometimes. That little finger thing creeps me out a bit because little kids like kind of scare me when they're not asleep. And parents, like, no, I know, like, Wes, there's been
like
a moment
that.
When you're rocking.
My son, he was probably a year and a half old, and he came into bed with us. My son never slept. He just would not sleep at night for the first couple years of his life. And my wife brought him into bed with us, and I'm asleep. And she wakes me up. She goes, Dave, he's really creeping me out here. He was looking around the bed. All right. He was following, like, from one side of the bed to the other. He was looking. He was smiling. He was reaching out as if he saw something walking around our bed. At 2 o'clock in the morning, my wife got the TV on. She's watching it with the baby there. I was fast asleep. And my wife's like, he's really creeping me out. And I'm like, well, Jesus Christ, now I'm creeped out. I could have slept through this. Why the hell did you wake me up? I didn't even know this.
I don't need
to
know.
Sure enough, he's reaching out, he's smiling, and he's looking from her side of the bed to my side of the bed, back to her side of the bed, as if he saw something, as if he was trying to communicate with something. And this was at our house in North Wales that I'm absolutely convinced was haunted. I have several stories of that house.
I don't like this.
See,
like
this is why this little kid's performance is frightening, because it could be real.
Well, the only thing I don't like about it, I just don't like that thumb thing he does. And it's interesting because from what I read, the kid actor came up with that on the set. And Kubrick was like, yeah, let's roll with that. But
I think it's so over the top it works. That's another example.
Come and play with us. Play with us, Daddy. Forever and ever and ever.
Let's get into the heart of this episode and the stuff that I really wanted to discuss on this episode. So
we're already tapped out, Wes. Wes is like,
I know.
I haven't gotten to anything I want. He's like, screw this. Screw these guys. Wes is gonna remember that solo pod Dave was talking about. This is gonna,
I see Wes starting a solo cast.
All right. So this section of it is we're going to do some theories about The Shining. We're going to talk through some of these. There's three of them. I'm going to interweave these through the next few segments here. Moving on from the book and switching over just to talking about the 1980 film. You know, the film, it's been one of the most analyzed films of the 20th century. Loads of theories that have been made into YouTube videos. There's essays written, frame by frame breakdowns, and even documentaries, which the wonderful 2012's Room 237, that's a great documentary. I think it's important to keep in mind before you guys even start answering the questions that I have on the theories is a couple of things. So it's easy to say, no way, you know, that's people just looking too far into things. However, these theories are based off of artistic choices that Stanley Kubrick deliberately made for the film. You know, they don't have a basis in the book. Plus, Kubrick was a notoriously exacting filmmaker who would do exhaustive research, exhaustive planning, and set up prior to shooting a frame of his movies. Plus, it's very well documented and known that a lot of times he would throw in these kind of metaphorical things just to see where audiences would go with it. So I fully believe that he purposefully put special meanings and things into his films for us to debate and talk about. So I wanted to say that before we get into this. So what we're going to do, we're going to play a little game of buy or sell the theory. And we're going to do three of them, but I'm not going to do all three theories in a row. We're going to do one, we'll talk about something else, and then come back. So first up is the moon landing theory. So there's a popular theory that the United States never actually went to the moon and that the whole thing was faked. There's tons of websites devoted to breaking down everything. Anyway, due to Stanley's brilliant directing of 2001 A Space Odyssey, the theory states that the government, United States government, hired Stanley Kubrick to shoot footage using front projection technology of the Apollo 11 moon landing in July of 1969. And The Shining has Easter eggs in it that basically is Stanley Kubrick admitting or confessing that he's done that. Let me give you the little pointers here, and then we're going to go around and just tell me. We don't have to get too far into it. Just do you buy or sell the theory and just a brief explanation of why. Okay. Number one, the big thing is Danny's knitted Apollo 11 sweater. This was specifically knitted for the film. It was not purchased. Room 237, which Kubrick changed from King's book, which 237 meant to be the distance between the Earth and the moon. The carpet pattern in the hotel represents the Apollo launch pad. The tirade that Jack goes on to Wendy talking about how she doesn't understand duty of work and honoring a contract, which is supposedly how Stanley was feeling under the stress of the project. And then finally, the family's isolation in the story is like Kubrick keeping this big secret. So this is a popular moon landing. I'm just going to go ahead real quick and tell you what I think on it, and then I'll get you guys, tell me, do you buy or sell it? I'm selling this theory. I think it's a little ludicrous. It's kind of ridiculous. There's hardly even any connecting nuggets in the movie. But anyway, what do you guys have to say? T-Man, we'll start with you. Buy or sell this.
Basically, you're asking me, what's, it's not about did he fake the moon landing or not, right? You're not asking me that.
In a way, I mean, yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, in a way, I am. I'm asking you, do you buy into this theory? Or are you selling this theory of The Shining being about the confession of the moon landing?
So I think there's two different things. There's the moon landing theory, which is truly that is so ludicrous. There is no way that is true. That would be the biggest. It's just so stupid. It's not even. Enough to talk about. It's funny, yeah. Oh, he faked the moon landing, but that would be the biggest cover up in human history, basically. Anyway, about the movie though, I don't think that Kubrick was saying I did it. I think he was having a laugh about it. I think basically he's, you know, the term is like he's kind of poking you in the eye of saying, "Hey, you guys think I faked the moon landing? Well, here's some stuff to laugh about."
Gabe, buy or sell?
sell the crud out of that. First of all, the moon landing thing, that's nothing. Like, I mean, we got billionaires going to space just for funsies now. So we know that the moon landing was real. Like,
that's fake.
It could be fake too. Maybe they're fake going, you know, and maybe it's just social media post. Who knows? But let's not get into that. But the moon landing's real. Thing number two, though, that the 237 thing was not because of the distance to the moon. Really, in the book, it was 217. But the hotel itself, the one that they actually shot it at in Oregon, was like, look, we have actual guests that come to this hotel, and there's a 217. So we don't want to use this so people be frightened to stay
exactly.
in it.
Exactly.
But they the most requested room now is 217. Funny enough,
anyway, right.
It's like it didn't matter, but it wasn't
backfired on him.
That like that's going into too deep of a theory for me because that's why that happened. It doesn't have anything to do with the distance, but it is a nice coincidence. So,
Dave, what do you think? You buying or selling?
You know what? As I was watching Room 237, the guy was making very interesting points. But if Kubrick did direct the moon landing, as they said, it's the worst shit he ever directed in his life. So see him directing that. I mean, that footage is like a camera mounted on a ship. And, you know, they're saying, oh, he's doing that. No, Kubrick, he's never directed anything so crappy in his life. If he directed that moon landing, I sell it. I say to the guy, turn it sideways and shove it up your ass. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. No, I don't buy it at all. And that for that reason alone.
Let's get into a different segment. I'm going to come back. And I think, in my opinion, a couple of the next couple of theories, I think actually could potentially hold a little water. So we'll get into that in just a bit. So just history of the film and the impact. It's really not that interesting of a story, but basically after the lackluster success of Barry Lyndon, Kubrick realized he needed to make a commercial appealing film that would also hold his attention. And he was always interested in the horror genre, which I feel like some of the other films, you can see that. Anyway, after he famously passed on directing The Exorcist, he felt this new horror novel from a popular writer could be material he was looking for. And it turned out to be. And he hired Diane Johnson to collaborate with him on the screenplay. And she was a writer and a UC Berkeley literature professor who was teaching a course on the novel The Shining. And he hired her to help him write the screenplay. So the rest is pretty much history in regard to making of the film. It, of course, had a prolonged and strenuous production period, long work days that were typical of Kubrick's productions. He did screen David Lynch's Eraserhead for the cast and crew before they started actually shooting to show them the mood that he was trying to achieve for the film, which I thought was actually really interesting. So, guys, not a lot really going on with how the film came together. Hey, pretty standard. Yeah.
So there is one funny story I read was that, I don't know if you read this or not, that when he was trying to pick out a horror book, like a movie or like a book to adapt, that his secretary was in the next room. And he asked her, give me all the best or most popular horror books you can think of.
Yep.
She brought them to him. He was reading and she would just hear it like hit the wall. Because she knew that meant that he didn't like it. Like he would start reading one and just be like, hit the wall. And then when she gave him The Shining, she said she'd never heard it hit the wall.
And actually probably should have put that in there because that was more interesting than the stuff that I went over.
What's really interesting is at the time he didn't, because I'm looking at this. And one of the things I read in this book that I had referenced is that Kubrick started this process 5 years before the film came out. He started the process earlier. He got the transcript of The Shining before the novel was actually published, yeah. I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So
he did.
Stephen wrote a screenplay and he didn't even like read it.
No, yeah, right. He didn't even look at it. But if you look at the timeline of Stephen King adaptations, The Shining coming out in 1980, what would it be? The third Stephen King adaptation? Because before it, you had Carrie in 76, Brian De Palma's Carrie. And you had Salem's Lot in 79, the TV miniseries directed by Toby Hooper. However, in development, Kubrick would have started development on The Shining before either of those movies came out. Mm-hmm. So he would have been, it would have been like the first Stephen King adaptation if Kubrick had been like sort of a standard filmmaker and turned a movie around in a year. But that's not Kubrick. We know that.
Right.
Kubrick takes years and years. One of the, I have a book that I bought back in either 83 or 84 called Film Yearbook, and it's out of England. And it's just a yearbook of reviews of films, best films of the year, worst films of the year, quotes of the year, everything. And one of the quotes is from Jack Nicholson. Somebody actually asked him to define Stanley Kubrick. And Jack Nicholson's quote was, "Define Kubrick brings new meaning to the word meticulous." And that's what Kubrick was, a meticulous filmmaker. He would just take his time, 6-7 years to make a movie. After The Shining, his next movie was Full Metal Jacket, which was 7 years later, 1987. 7 years later, and you know he started that. The Vietnam craze started basically in 1986 when Oliver Stone released Platoon. And it won Best Picture. And then you saw a lot of Vietnam movies released around that time. You saw Hamburger Hill. You know, about Vietnam veterans returning home in country with Bruce Willis. You know, just a lot of Vietnam movies. And Full Metal Jacket came out in that group. But you know Kubrick started it years before Platoon was even conceived. That's just the way he worked. And it's the way he worked with The Shining as well, that it was so many years before any of these other movies were released. His could have been the first Stephen King adaptation if it wasn't Stanley Kubrick directing it.
Well, before we get into the next theory, I did want to bring up one more time, Dave, you started talking about it with the Steadicam and with Garrett Brown. And I don't think, you know, if you're not really as much into film as we are, it was just such an important part of the movie. And like you said, Dave, he actually brought him on set. And Garrett Brown said that the fast flowing camera movements in the maze, you know, and then with Danny pedaling around the halls, you know, those would have been impossible to do those shots without the Steadicam. And the dude that invented it, Garrett Brown, actually said, "I refine my own abilities with the technology working on The Shining." So I thought that was really cool.
I was going to ask you guys how the Big Wheels shot was shot, because it was just so cool. Because I'd never, you know, that I think that was the best shot of the film.
And Garrett Brown, I think, I don't know if he first invented it or he first used that movie on Rocky. When Rocky is running up the stairs at the art museum in Philadelphia.
He did. It was invented in 1975, and came out in 76.
I think the first three movies
was Bound of Glory and Rocky were the first two.
I noticed what Dave noticed. I noticed the sound during that section, carpet hardwood, or whatever the floor was. And I noticed how steady the cam was and how it quickly followed him. And I was just like, you know, I'm not a film buff. I don't read about things. Like, Wes loves reading about this stuff, but I don't afterwards read about these things. So I was like, I'm going to ask that question tonight, and I'm glad you guys covered it.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we get back on the other side, we're going to get into theory number two, which is a doozy. Hey, listeners, if you've been listening to our recent episodes, you've been hearing about the epic sci-fi book series Shadowed Stars by author Stephen Couts. We're so excited to have Stephen as a partner of Real Talk a Movie podcast, because Shadowed Stars incorporates all the aspects of storytelling that most of us movie fans love. As the movie buddy always says, he likes when the story transports the audience to a different world, and that's exactly what Stephen is doing with the book series. Shadowed Stars is an epic science fiction series, but as we learned on our recent interview series episode with Stephen, he likes to incorporate other genres into his books, such as romance, horror, action, and even westerns, which I love that approach. Now, I do want to caution that Shadowed Stars is for a mature audience, so I don't recommend tucking the kids into bed while reading chapters from the book. It being for a mature audience is another aspect that I think is very unique, as we normally don't get that with other sci-fi epics. Stephen has 8 numbered books planned in the series, The odd-numbered books will focus on one line of characters. The even-numbered books will focus on another line of characters, with some cameos mixed in. This helps to keep the stories fresh and the character arcs forming over the entire series. Listeners, I can't encourage you enough to check out Shadowed Stars. Book 1 is available now, and so is Book 2, Shadowed Stars, The Reign of the Black Guard. Steven is hopeful that Book 3 will be available by the end of 2021. Now, where can you purchase these books? Book 1 and 2, again, available now. Head over to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Walmart, iTunes, you name it. For more information on Shadowed Stars and author Steven Kautz, visit shadowedstarsbooks.com. All right. Again, we're going to play a little buy or sell the theory with our panel here. And this next theory was made popular by Rob Ager. And he is a British internet film critic who is honestly, if you've ever looked into his stuff, he is brilliant. He is a really smart guy. And I really like his takes. This one in particular is a bizarre one, but he can almost convince you of it if you look into his stuff. And you can check out more of that work on collativelearning.com. Okay, so the title of this theory is Danny's Ordeal and the Bear Costume Man. So the theory goes back to before the story picks up. Rob says that Danny has suffered terribly at the hands of his father. Physical abuse, mental abuse, and in the case of this theory, Danny was sexually abused, and the scary images in the hotel are manifestations of his horror. So the key to unlocking this theory is towards the end of the film, we see an image of a man in a bear costume. The flap of the costume over the buttocks is open, exposing his rear. And he is performing, we'll call them services, on another hotel guest. And it's a really weird and disturbing, shocking image. And as we work backwards through the film, we kind of see this theory come together. So let's start with Danny and the psychiatrist. She asked Danny if Tony, his imaginary, you know, about Tony, you know, his imaginary friend, does he ever ask you to do things? And Danny doesn't want to answer. Again, in the book, Tony plays a much larger role. But in this version of The Shining, he doesn't. And so he's just kind of there. We know Danny has this imaginary friend. And kids actually use imaginary friends to talk about or express things that they themselves don't want to say. So while Danny is talking to the psychiatrist, he has made up this imaginary friend to kind of deal with the trauma from his father. You see there's a bear pillow behind him. The bear's eyes and mouth are wide open. And if you compare that to the design to the elevator dials and doors inside the hotel, they are almost identical. Go back and watch it. All right, let's move on to things that actually occur at the hotel. And this might be the most damning of evidence. When the hotel manager greets Jack, Jack is sitting reading a Playgirl magazine. And that particular issue of Playgirl magazine has an article highlighted on the cover titled, Incest, Why Do Parents Sleep With Their Children? And that was in the real issue of Playgirl. In Danny's bedroom at the Overlook, hanging above his bed, there's a framed picture of two bears. One is sitting, one is standing. There are many bear props throughout the entire film. There's a bear rug at the hotel, amongst other things. But these three main times the camera is focused in on the bears is the pillow, the pictures in Danny's room, the bear costume man, and all three times these motifs take place in a bedroom. I'm almost done here with this theory, and I want to get your guys' thoughts. So the last thing about the bear costume man to tying him to Danny is during the partial view of the bear costume man, before he starts to lean back from his bed, side by side, if you match it with the scene where Danny is brushing his teeth in the mirror before he has his first shining vision, those scenes, if you line them up side to side, are the identical movements. They are the same scene. in relation to Jack, when Danny goes to get his fire engine out of the bedroom, he's terrified of his dad. Walks over slowly to him. You get the sad, ominous music. And, you know, his dad asks if he's ever going to hurt him. And then also the way that Danny, after he has his attack or whatever happens in room 237, where his shirt's torn and he's sucking his thumb and he's injured and shaken, is, you know, kind of all tying this together. So I know that was a lot of stuff there, but this theory is really bizarre and I almost am bought into it just a little bit. So, gentlemen, do you buy or sell the theory that The Shining's undertones are about the horrific mental damage of sexual abuse? Dave, let's start with you.
All right. First off, let me just say, Wes, I love that you brought in collative learning. I have been following Rob Ager for probably 7-8 years. I'm not sure how long he's been out there. I agree with him 15 to 20% of the time. There are times I think this guy is like way off the mark with what he's saying about these movies, but he's intelligent and I love the way he gets behind what he says and he presents it. With this theory, you know, it's either buy or sell. Can I rent? can I rent the theory? Because
I love that. Yeah,
because the fact that it's Rob Ager, and I watch his videos all the time, even though I seldom agree with the guy. I don't agree with him. He is a smart, intelligent. He's really smart. He really is. When you watch his videos, you're like, wow, this guy put a lot of thought into something that is total bullshit, but he put thought into it and you want to watch it and you want it to be real. It's almost like you're rooting for Rob Ager to be right. You really are. I really do love watching his videos. When I see, I actually subscribe to his channel, and when something pops up from Rob Ager, I watch it right away. Not because I think I'm going to agree with it, but because he's so interesting in the way he presents it. So I'm going to say rent. I rent Rob Ager's theory on The Shining. However, with what he's saying and the way you described it, it may not be too far off the it may not be too far off the beaten track.
All right, Gabe, what about you? You buying or selling this theory?
I'm going to do my thing that Wes hates the most during this section, but I'm going to first off say buy 100% because I'm going to read my notes here, and I know Wes hates it when I get to my like fourth note, so I'll only do three this time. So note one was, man, that furry scene seemed out of place, because that furry scene does seem out of place unless this is true. My second note is punch 1 6-year-old in the face and she'll never let me forget about it. And that's funny, but it's not really funny. And if he had done what he did, it makes more sense. And then my last note is what happens in room 237 stays in room 237, right, Jack? I know that doesn't like coalesce here, but like it's clear that Jack could do, he hooks up with that hot then turns witch girl, and he didn't even tell, and his wife immediately asked it about it, and he's like, ah, nothing happened. I don't know. And he's probably like back in room 237, like later on that night, like seeing if the hot girl's there or not. But you know, he doesn't talk about it. So it's like, you know that he could do some malicious stuff and not talk about it. So I'm buying.
T-Man, what about you? I know you don't like these theories much, but what do you think about this one?
No, I'm selling it.
No,
this is stupid. Here's the problem with these theories is that you can do this for anything. Any movie you can do this for. You would have to basically say that Kubrick planned this all from the get-go, because anybody can make any type of thing you want from when you're watching something. But it matters what the intent of it is. If the filmmakers and the screenwriters and the whoever weaves the themes in, then that's what you're supposed to get out of it. If not, then you're just kind of making it up as you go along. There's lots of themes you can pull from movies because that's the intent of it. That's the purpose of what they're going for. With this is just bullshit. I mean, I'll be completely honest with you. It's like when you're watching The Godfather and I come to you guys like, hey, guys, check this out. I got this thing. Did you know The Godfather is about the Holocaust? Did y'all know that? Let me show you how. you know, when Sonny Corleone and he dies and all those bullets, that's the that means the 8 million Jews. That's what it's, you know, that's what it's symbolically meaning. Do y'all know that? I bet you didn't.
Well, okay, that's a bit of a stretch from what.
No, it's not. That's the same basic concept. It is the same thing. When they do this stuff, they're analyzing all these things. They're just making it up. It is literally just made up.
I gotta say, and I tend to agree more with Tommy on this one, because watching Room 237 again, this was my second viewing of it. I reviewed it for the blog years ago. And I watched it again, you know, prior to recording this episode. I think I rolled my eyes more this time than I did the previous time with a lot of the theories. Yes. And it's so funny because I think at one point, one of the people in Room 237 says, you know, even if the director or the filmmaker didn't intend it at first, you can still see it there. No, that doesn't work. You know, if the filmmaker didn't intend it, you can read all you want into it. It's not there.
See, I don't know. I'm buying it. I'm not.
He's like, screw you guys. Well, I think all this stuff in Room 237, this Rob Eggers theory, all these internet videos, YouTube theories, at the end of the day, how I view it is this. It's just for fun. If you want to go down that rabbit hole and like look at all that stuff and have fun with it, then that's fine. But don't say that's what the
movie is. Hold on, Tommy. I do want to battle you here. Explain the furry scene for me then. Because until I heard that theory, I just heard it. This is the first time I've ever heard it. I was like, what the heck? What's up with that furry scene? Because it makes no sense.
Yeah, the movie, I mean, Kubrick's just screwing with you. He's just putting all sorts of weird stuff in there.
So you're just doing that just randomly?
Yeah. Try to make sense of it. But here's the thing. So you think Kubrick planned all that stuff. You're saying that was Kubrick's intent and that he, all those things, he designed the screenplay and the movie around all of that.
I don't know about that, but I just know that furry scene doesn't make any sense. It made me laugh. I laughed
out loud. That's what you're saying. Kubrick planned all that. And if that's what he's saying, I don't have an issue. Oh, okay. But there's no proof of any of that. Kubrick never came out, or you're really just reading into stuff. And that's what I was making. I was doing a huge parody with the Godfather thing is then people are just making stuff up. He literally just making it up, because you could do that with anything that you watch in any movie. You could draw comparisons on all sorts of stuff and do side by side shots, especially on these YouTube videos when they do like side by side shots and look at this matches this and this and this. And you're just going down a rabbit hole at the end of the day.
I agree with you for the most part. Most of them are rabbit holes, but this one I'm buying a little bit. This is a little different.
Hey, like this one.
It's not, you know, of the two, if it comes to
I'm sold
faking
on this
the
one
moon landing or Danny suffering, you know, incest, I'm going to go with Danny suffering incest before I go to the moon landing. Of the two that we've talked about so far, yes.
I just can't explain the furry scene. So, like, I don't know. Like, that's why it draws me to it.
I'm sorry to differ with you, sir. But you are the caretaker. You've always been the caretaker.
Let's just go round table. Everybody just do one scene, and if somebody takes your scene, just pick your second favorite scene. But we could talk a little bit about our favorite scenes from The Shining. So, T-Man, let's start with you. You got first stab at what's the best scene, or what's your favorite scene for The Shining?
I think real quick, I like the ending when Kubrick, like when Jack is going crazy. Like, I know we were talking about his performance. Like I said, I like his performance. It's so entertaining. How can you not like it? So I think my favorite scene is when I want to save one of them because I know this is what you all will pick. And since you all love the movie more than me, I want to save that for you all. The other one that I think is the best. But this is really the second best one, I think, is when he's cutting down the doors with the axe. And the shot is amazing with the camera kind of going tilting back and forth with the axe. And, you know, Danny's trying to escape. And then Jack comes in with, you know, Dave, you were talking about, he's like, I'll huff and I'll puff. And, he, you know, then he comes in, he's like, it's Johnny. I mean, and that's where I think Kubrick is doing this on purpose. This is when people talk about, like, what's Kubrick's vision. This, in my mind, this is what Kubrick is going for. Like, it's almost like it is funny on purpose. Like, it's not even scary anymore. Like, it's a parody or like almost like so over the top. Like, he is literally making Johnny Carson jokes by the end of the movie. So, like, it is. That's where Kubrick's doing that. Like, he's hitting you on purpose over the head with this. Is like, look how over the top I'm taking this. And if you're riding with it, you kind of enjoy that aspect. And I really like that scene.
Quick, I want to throw this out there because you mentioned that, Tommy, about the Johnny Carson. I don't know the age of the rest of you, but I was young when The Shining first came out. And I remember every now and again, my parents would let me stay up late. And I remember watching The Johnny Carson Show, there was a Tonight episode where they opened with Jack Nicholson breaking through the door. You know how it was Ed McMahon who always say, "Here's Johnny." They opened it with Jack Nicholson breaking through the door and saying, "Here's Johnny." And they went to Johnny Carson. He said, "Just so you know, ladies and gentlemen, we did not arrange that. That was in the movie. That was actually in the movie." They opened the Tonight Show with that segment from The Shining. I remember watching it live. That was the first time I saw The Shining. Was seeing that moment. I hadn't even seen the movie at that point. Was seeing that moment from the Tonight Show where he breaks through the door and goes, "Here's Johnny."
Well, kind of gets to what I was saying earlier. Is like the movie became so ingrained in the culture. It's hard to then like look at it as just a horror movie. I mean, that they were doing that joke before when the movie was even coming out. So that's pretty amazing.
You're right. You're absolutely right. They absolutely were.
And Dave, just go right ahead. What's your favorite scene?
My favorite scene, and I'm going back to that viewing when I was sitting watching it on cable. That terrified me was the ending when they're going through that maze, when Jack is chasing Danny through that maze. There was something about it that just sat with me and that terrified me. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't know what it was until today. And I read this book, and I'm just going to read a passage from this. All right, if you can give me a minute, I'm going to read a passage from the book that I referenced at the beginning. Again, just for everyone, is Stanley Kubrick director, A Visual Analysis, written by Alexander Walker, Sybil Taylor, and Ulrich Röhke. And in this book, it talks about that final sequence, okay? One of the things it talks about is that Kubrick was very much influenced by German expressionism. You know, movies like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and all of these films, these German expressionist films. And it says at the end, it sort of goes over, it has this paragraph about it, about how, you know, how he sort of related to them. But at the end of it, and I'm going to read this verbatim from the book. It says, German directors of the pre-Hitler period would have clustered enormous shadows into the rooms, corridors, and vistas. Kubrick substituted the high wattage of plausible reality. The Shining is about fear in a well-lit place. Terror would not vanish if one turned on the lights. And I read that early this morning and I watched The Shining again. This movie, all of the horror takes place in well-lit areas. Even in the scenes where Jack, you know, in the scenes where Jack is going through the hotel, when Wendy is asleep, when people are asleep in this movie, it's well lit. There is light. Even in the scene with Red Rum, where Danny comes walking in or whoever it was, you know, whether it was Danny or whether it was, Tony with Red Rum. It's well lit, but that final scene through the maze is where it's finally in the darkness. And you finally see faces obscured by shadows. You didn't see that through the rest of the movie. Nowhere else in the movie are there shadows. There are scenes that are more well lit than others, but yet you see everything in that final scene. All three of them, Wendy, Danny, Jack, their faces are obscured at one point or another. It's dark. And that, when I was watching that movie at the end, I was absolutely terrified as a kid, as I was watching that final sequence, thinking, you know, when Danny was trying to get through the maze, Jack could pop out at any goddamn minute. And I was on the edge of my seat. It's at the very, very end of the movie where darkness plays into the film. The rest of the film is all in light. There's no darkness. It's at that final sequence where Kubrick is sort of putting it into the realm of the typical horror. That, for me, is my favorite sequence, the final sequence of that movie.
Excellent stuff. I had not thought of that before, but that's great. Yeah, T-Man, what did you have to say?
I was just
going to
say, Dave, and don't forget about Jack's just like his screaming.
Oh, yeah, he was. He was like, it's almost like he was having a stroke. He was
amazing.
Holding his chest, but I got the feeling watching it today, watching it again, that he was having a stroke, because if you're hearing him, he's not even intelligible. What he's saying is not even making sense. It's like his mind is finally melting and he's having a stroke. He's holding his chest, but his mind is failing him.
Well, then he's like, hey, Danny boy.
Yeah.
Gabe, what about yours? What's your favorite scene in The Shining?
First of all, Dave, I love your passion with that. Like, I mean, I felt it because that scene never really stuck with me, because like all I thought about is this time that I snuck out in the snow and my dad was like, and I told my dad, my parents asked me, did you sneak out last night? I was like, no. And they're like, and my dad goes, really? Yeah, no, I didn't do it. And he walked back to my back door, like in my house where I had a balcony. And he goes, okay, so explain these snow tracks. And I was like, yeah, so I snuck out. You know, it was one of those moments when I was like a kid. I was like, oh, yeah, you got me.
You should have retraced the steps.
I know. I should have learned from this movie. My favorite scene was by far the discussion between the lead chef and Danny explaining The Shining. It's because you don't think that they're going to get along at first. And when that discussion starts happening, that's the thing that I'm scared of. I'm scared of The Shining. I don't believe in ghosts. I don't believe in exorcisms. And I've talked about that like openly. Like those parts don't scare me. Pop out scare me. And like The Shining scares me because I actually do believe in it, because a couple of things have happened in my life where I believe it's real. So that conversation creates a realness that frightens me. So it's scary.
And your daughter has ESP. So,
and now Dave said found that is really frightening me. Like, I have to go sleep in the bed.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do that to you.
I didn't know that was an actual thing. I'd never read about it. Now I'm freaked.
Well, to finish this segment up real quick, I have not talked a whole lot about the movie and my thoughts, just kind of more about the outline, but really a tie between the room 237 scene where Jack goes in and Gabe was kind of, you know, making light of it. But it is a pretty freaky scene, you know. Just I love the way that it plays out, and Jack goes in there and he sees the woman getting out of the bathtub, and I just love the heartbeat and just the cut back of the like rotted woman in the bathtub. I'm not even talking about like once she's already got out of the tub and they're embracing, and then it cuts back to her like laying under the water. It's just that actually does creep me out. Even today, it is still pretty creepy. The best scene of the movie, I think the absolute best scene, is where Wendy goes to find Jack, finds his manuscripts that read "All work and no play make Jack a dull boy." Him pursuing her up the steps until ultimately she smacks him over the top of the head, knocking him out. I think that is one of the best scenes, best acted, most intense, just best scenes in movie history. And this is the scene that is so famous for being shot like 120-something times however many takes that they did on it. And I wanted to take just a quick second to talk about Shelley Duvall, because she, I think, is unfairly criticized for her performance in this movie. I love her performance. In her personal life, she was under immense stress during this time. And then Kubrick was notoriously hard on her. And I don't want to get into tonight, we don't have time to really get into, you know, whether that is is a good thing of what he was doing to get the performance out of her, but he basically just hounded her, was so hard on her. He tortured her. He mentally broke her for the role. And that is where it comes out the most, is during that particular scene.
The way I look at it is Kubrick, as smart as a filmmaker as he was, and as sharp as he was, you know, everyone sort of looks at Shelley Duvall saying, oh, yeah, her performance, you know, wasn't the greatest. Kubrick is not a filmmaker who would allow that to happen. He would not have continued with her if he didn't think that she was up to the task. There was something about Shelley Duvall in that movie. Yes, the character she was playing is very submissive. You know, she's not as strong until the end of the movie, where you see her getting the strength to defend her son against her husband. You know, I think he eventually saw, even though he pushed her, I think the reason he was pushing her was to get what he wanted out of her. And Shelley Duvall saw that later on. She actually said that she respected Stanley Kubrick and she loved him for what he got, you know, for what he was able to bring out of her in that role.
Yeah, I think I remember reading that she said that she ran out of tears because she had been crying so much, which is absolutely a little ludicrous at that point. I mean, it gets to the point of like you said, Wes, we don't want to relitigate that. I think there's a lot, and Kubrick's not the only one that he's been known for that. You know, directors used to slap, you know, I remember reading stories about a director slapping his actresses to get the performance that they wanted.
Yeah.
I mean, this has been a thing they've done for a long time. Is it right? No. But there's a lot of things that could be its own episode probably.
She eventually understood. She understood what Kubrick was trying to get from her. And I think that speaks volumes.
When you talk about that stuff, it's about bullying in a lot of ways too.
It is. Yes, absolutely. He
picked on the weaker person. But like you said, Wes, we don't want to get into it because that could be its
I'm cracking thing. Up. We're into it.
Can I say one thing? When I told my friend, a friend of the show, Russ Carter, we were talking about this. He was like, the first thing out of his mouth was like, hey, Shelley Duvall went crazy because of this filming. Did you read about that? And that was the first thing that he said. I believe it. Honestly, I feel bad for her because she's great in the film.
The final thing I'll say on this, and I don't want to get too far into this either because this could be its own thing, is, you know, it gets to the point with some of these directors, and I think that it's to the point when they get so powerful that, like, nobody wants to tell them no. And Kubrick had gotten to that point. There's others like David Fincher, who is very well known for this. When you're getting to the point where you're doing 100 takes, it gets a little ludicrous at a certain point.
Yeah.
It's for their own ego, really. Like, could you really tell? Is that 100th really better than that 99th?
Yeah, exactly. 100 takes. Jesus Christ. How could you sit right there and go through 100 takes?
It's a little ludicrous to that point. It's like, that's when they become too powerful. And I think that's what happened with Kubrick, where his ego to a certain point, like, nobody could tell him no, really. And it broke Shelley Duvall, and the only reason it didn't break Jack is because Jack's crazy.
Jack already was too big. Jack was like Tom Cruise. He didn't care. You could have said anything.
And Kubrick was protecting him in a way. You know, Kubrick was really impressed with what Jack Nicholson was giving him, to the point that Kubrick was rewriting scenes day to day based on Nicholson's performance. I don't even think Nicholson realized that at the beginning.
I can't imagine a better person. Like I think she knocks it out.
I don't either. I don't think that you could have cast a better actress. You know, it's funny because I always thought Shelley Duvall's perfect role was Olive Oil in 1980s Popeye. Yeah. I thought she was perfect. I thought you can't get better than Shelley Duvall to play Olive Oil.
What's funny is she went straight from filming this to that.
That's hilarious.
She was like, I need some movie that's like not going to tell
it clean today.
Red rum! Red rum! Red rum! Red rum!
Stop it!
Red rum!
Get me!
Red rum!
All right, the final theory that we're going to unpack tonight, forget the moon landing, forget the bear costume. This popular theory states, and Gabe, since you've bought into one of these theories, I'm excited. So this popular theory states that the true undertones of The Shining are a metaphor for the cultural assimilation or genocide of the Native Americans, you know, the manifest destiny, if you will. This is probably my favorite theory and the one that I actually could see Kubrick may have pre-planned or purposely put some stuff in here. So here's the case for this theory. We get the tribal music in the opening and the echoed voices that sound like chanting throughout the movie. Very tribalistic. When Stuart Ullman, who's the hotel manager, is talking to Jack at the beginning of the movie, he tells Jack the hotel was built on a Native American burial ground. That's not in the book. That was purposefully put in the movie. Plus, the hotel has an elevator. That means that it has an elevator shaft. So that means whenever they were building it, they had to dig deep into the burial mound during the construction of the hotel, which kind of unlocks the spirits. Plus, Ullman, if you notice him, he's interestingly dressed in the red, white, and blue. Hotel, it was presumably built between 1907 and 1909. Ullman actually mentions this as well, that they had to fight off a few Indian attacks. Obviously, that meant probably killing them and burying more Indians right there. Many decorations and motifs throughout the motel are of Native American and the American West, including that very large sand painting that's in the hotel. Wendy says the phrase, "Keep America Clean," which that referenced to a 1971 campaign, Keep America Beautiful, which famously featured a crying Native American. We've got the blood pouring out of the elevator doors, which again, that shaft has pierced into the burial ground. You've got the Calumet baking powder, which is often visible in important scenes, which of course is its mascot is a Native American with the full feather head garb. And then finally, Jack tells the bartender, which I don't even know why he said this when he's drinking his whiskey. He said, "White man's burden, Lloyd. White man's burden." So gentlemen, do we buy or sell this theory that The Shining's undertones are about the genocide of the Native Americans through manifest destiny? And Gabe, let's start with you.
Yeah, I'll go ahead. Wes, you bought it. I'm 100% buying it. I love how, like, when they tell you about, like, the hotel, they say, and there's just, he's, like, telling, like, it's in the interview that Dave talked about. He's like, and there's just, like, this little thing I got to tell you about. There was this guy, he murdered his entire family with an axe and then put two barrels of a shotgun in his mouth and pulled the trigger. Tiny detail. Oh, also, side note, we built this hotel on an Indian burial ground. No biggie. And it's like, you know what it reminded me of? Like those drug commercials that you see on TV. It will 100% cure your depression, but you also could lose a kidney and simultaneously may get measles and give it to your entire family. Kind of reminded me of that, like how he like threw that at the end of the thing. But no, I buy it because it doesn't make any sense for them to throw in that Indian burial ground. Why would they throw that in? So, like, I'll buy that.
Dave, what about you? You buying this one or selling this theory?
You know, of all the theories in room 237, I'm going to say buy. And only, you know, I don't know that I buy it 100%, but knowing the type of filmmaker that Stanley Kubrick was, this movie had tons of Native American imagery and references throughout it did. There's no way that Kubrick didn't understand that at some point, you know, that he didn't put them in there. And there's talk of it, you know, when you look at room 237, there's talk of Kubrick doing tons of research into the history of Colorado and the fact that they're, you know, looking into the Native American, I guess, populace at that time. Of all the theories in room 237, this is the one that I would come closest to buying.
I hate to talk more because I've talked quite a bit, but I do want to say one other thing. There's a rumor that he typed out the 100 pages of All Work and No Play Makes Jack a Dull Boy. Like, that's how, like, intense he was. And the mirror his scene.
His secretary typed him out. Yeah, he had her do it. She worked on it for literally months.
And how cool is it?
Because of the spelling errors. But, yeah, like, that's how meticulous this guy is. So you're telling me that he didn't put these Indian products in there? And that's why I go back to the furry scene. Like, I honestly am buying both of these theories.
We ain't going back to that fur. That
go back to the furry theory.
Well, so this one is an interesting one. And I've heard this one quite a bit, too, when it comes to this. So here, my thought on this is actually kind of similar to the Apollo 11 one. I don't think Kubrick designed The Shining to be saying this is what it is about. Like, I really don't think that. He does put a lot of Native American stuff in there, obviously. Like you said, Wes, when Jack just comes out like, white man's burden, Lloyd. Like, it's like, what is that even talking about at this point? I kind of think, this is my own personal opinion on it. I think it's Kubrick just messing with us again. Like, I think Kubrick, like we've talked about, he is a very meticulous director. He does a lot of research. But I also think watching Kubrick's films, you know, we've seen them all. We love Kubrick. He kind of has a playful comedic tone. Like, he kind of likes to play with his audience in a way. Like, he's very smart and he loves to kind of like mess with us. I think that's what he's doing with this. He's just putting all this stuff in there. It's like, hey, look, these people are idiots. They're just going to run with all this stuff. Like, let's just I'm just going to mess with them. And I think that's exactly what he did. And look at us idiots now, 40 years later, we're talking about it on this podcast. So mission accomplished, Stanley. You got us.
No, I buy this one. And there are a lot of movies that actually use this as a metaphor in there. And I thought it was really interesting how they did that. So I do think Kubrick knew what he was doing with this one and kind of purposefully put some of that type of stuff in there. Again, they designed all of the sets. This was not shot inside that hotel. They shot this in England, and he purposefully had all this stuff put in there. So,
little pigs, let me come in. Not by the hair on your chinny chin chin. Then I'll huff. And I'll puff, and I'll blow your house in.
Okay, guys, let's get into the last segment, and this is the one I've been most excited for. I want to talk about the end, and I don't mean the hedge maze. I'm talking about the very end of the movie. So, quick recap for the audience. Jack pursues Danny into the hotel's outdoor hedge maze. Danny fools Jack by tracing backwards over his own tracks and then escaping. Jack winds up lost, disoriented, mumbling, and literally freezes to death in the cold. Wendy and Danny escape in the snowcat that Halloran brought with him, which we haven't even talked about him, which I hate that. But anyway, so the final shot has the camera gliding through the hotel into the gold room, out into the hallway where rows of photographs from the hotel's past are hung. It hones in right at the photo in the center, which depicts a massive July 4th ball at the Overlook in 1921. And there, front and center, is Jack, smiling almost maniacally right into the camera as Midnight, The Stars and You by Henry Hall and the Glen Eagles Hotel Band plays hauntingly into the credits. So before I get your guys' thoughts on what this ending means, let's take a quick look at how the novel ends in comparison. Ending in the novel has many differences from the movie, chiefly the climax, which involves the hedge animals coming to life instead of the hedge maze. And Kubrick knew with technology then that they couldn't do that, so... And then in King's ending, the boilers explode from neglect and the Overlook burns down. Wendy, Danny, and a very much alive Dick Halloran, they all escape together. So Diane Johnson, who is the co-screenwriter, told Entertainment Weekly, the ending was changed almost entirely because Kubrick found it cliche just to blow everything up. He thought that there might be something else that would be metaphorically and visually more interesting. That's an exact quote from Diane Johnson. Now that we know in this case it truly was Kubrick's intent for a metaphorical ending, what do you think the ending of The Shining means?
I don't know. I'll give it the dumb answer. I thought that it means that that guy's always existed in this hotel. Like the guy that they claim that killed the two girls and his wife and then himself, like it's him. And he always exists there. Like no matter like what caretaker they get or whoever it is, he always exists there because of The Shining. And that's the point of the whole movie. And that's what makes it creepy.
I agree with you. I agree with you. Absolutely, Gabe. I think that when you look at the film, there's scenes where Jack says, I feel like I know this hotel. When I was taking the tour, I knew what was going to come around each corner as I was taking the tour of this hotel, even though it was supposedly the first time he ever walked in there. Jack and this hotel were one. And you get that at the end. You get the fact that they were connected, that they were always connected. Danny and Wendy were the variables. They were not connected to the hotel. Jack was. And it comes down to Jack either assimilating them, bringing them into the hotel, or them escaping. You know, you had Grady, the previous caretaker, not to get too deep into it, but, you know, he murdered his family. And you see his two young girls throughout this film appearing. It's different with Jack, but he was connected to that hotel. Fate had taken control and brought Jack back to that hotel. I agree with you 100%. I think that that is a key theme in this movie, that Jack was always meant to be in that hotel, but his family was not.
Well, here's the thing, Dave and Gabe. We did it. Kubrick tried to trick us. Kubrick thought he could get us, but we solved it. We got it, guys. Cooper, you can't get one over on us. Not on Real Talk.
So let me my personal thoughts, just all, it's always been a simple one, that the hotel pretty much was its own presence of evil, a sanctuary, you know, for evil events, and it just simply absorbed Jack into its history. However, let me run one more thing by you, and I've really been researching a lot and spending time thinking about the ending. And that personal thought that I've always had, people have just taken it a little bit deeper. And I want to cover that real quick. I think this is really interesting. And we'll get your guys' thoughts on that and then close. So the key to understanding the ending lies in the red bathroom scene while he's talking to Delbert Grady, who on the surface is just one of Jack's predecessors. Grady says, "You are the caretaker. You've always been the caretaker." He also says, "I should know, sir. I've always been here." What sticks out is that when Mr. Ullman is telling Jack about the murders at the beginning of the movie, he says that the caretaker's name was Charles Grady. Sure, I guess, you know, it could be Charles Delbert Grady, or Delbert is some kind of nickname. However, Delbert denies being the murderer that Jack heard about. Then he contradicts himself by saying that he corrected the girls. And when his wife tried to intervene, he corrected her too. Are both Grady's the same Grady? You know, were the names being different? Was that just a continuity error, which seems kind of strange for Kubrick?
I don't think it was a continuity error. I don't think it was a continuity error. I think it was the fact that, you know, that Charles Grady and Delbert Grady were the same person. It's just that Delbert Grady was the one who was, I guess, pulled into the hotel. He was pulled into becoming one with the hotel. You know, there's some awesome sequences in this movie. There's a scene, and we haven't talked about it too much, where Jack Torrance goes walking into the bar and he says, "Oh, I could do with a drink. I would sell my soul for a drink." And he buries his head in his hands. And the minute his eyes are, you know, he pulls his hands away and his eyes are opened, he goes, "Hey, Lloyd, how you doing?" It's like the bartender has been there the whole time, and he knew him. He knew exactly who he was. Funny, because you get that. It's funny that he says, "I would sell my soul for a drink." And at that moment, Lloyd the bartender appears.
I like that. That's a great thought.
Well, no wonder Delbert goes crazy. I mean, what a crappy name, Delbert. No wonder he kills his whole family and puts a shotgun in his head.
Well, also, there's no alcohol at the place.
Yeah.
5 months? No alcohol?
They pulled all the alcohol away from there.
What were they thinking?
Lloyd showed up to give Jack a drink.
I think Dave's on the right track here, but let's take it a step further, okay? So Mr. Ullman says the murders took place in 1970. But in the Jack and Grady scene, Grady is at a party full of roaring 20s-era ghosts. So it doesn't appear that Charles and Delbert were the same person. Could the two Gradys have worked at the Overlook at different times and both murdered their families? Maybe.
But I don't get that. I think that the fact that the Grady was pulled back to the past... I think that it's a fact of him being, he's Grady, but he's not Charles or Delbert at that point. He's part of the hotel's history. He was meant to be there, just like Jack Torrance was meant to be there. The hotel was calling him home. The fact that he had a wife and son was incidental. And was almost to the point of a distraction to the fact that Jack and this hotel were one. Let's get rid of them so that you can take your rightful place in the history of the Overlook Hotel.
So the explanation, so the ending that Jack, Charles, and Delbert, they're all just reincarnations of earlier hotel staff who are just doomed to repeat the same cycle of violence over and over, and Jack's descent into madness is just fulfilling this prophecy, because Jack himself is just a reincarnated soul from the original hotel staff. So,
and that makes it more terrifying.
Grady.
Yeah, that makes it more terrifying that they were predestined to become the characters they were and to do what they were going to do to their families. At that time, I think that adds to it. I think that makes this film even more horrifying when you take that into account.
Agreed. Gabe, T-Man, any thoughts on that ending right there, that idea of what that all means?
I agree. I like it.
Danny was the fly in the ointment. He was the one that fate was not figuring on.
Because he
had the talent of knowing. He had the talent of shining. He was that fate did not figure on in this. And the clash between father and son in this movie is really where the story lies.
Yeah, I guess you're right, because then the snowmobile wouldn't exist.
I think you hit it on the head there, Wes. I think it's a good analysis of it and a good kind of capping of kind of what the movie's about, what the very final shot's about. Like you said, Kubrick wanted to do a meta Oracle type ending, and I think you nailed it. Plus, this has given me the opportunity to talk about The Shining, which is one of the all-time great Simpsons episodes.
Fantastic.
I could not.
It is. It's one of my favorite Simpsons Treehouse of Horrors. Yes.
Yeah, we were just talking about it. It's one of probably the best Treehouse of Horrors.
Yes, it really is.
We talked about it for 20 minutes preceding the episode.
Yeah, and it's, of course, Homer and Jackal. So many great sequences, especially when Marge comes up to see what Homer's writing, and it's like normal. But then the light on the wall, it's like no beer and no cable make Homer a dull
something,
boy.
Something, yeah.
It's just amazing. So if you haven't checked out that Treehouse of Horror episode, you've got to go watch that.
If you love The Shining, you will love The Shining.
Yeah,
that's weird.
I thought the blood usually got out on the second floor. Like, there's so many things.
My favorite line in The Shining, and we've already talked about it, is Mr. Burns. He's the one who sort of draws them there. And he's like, Smithers said, you ever think that maybe the fact that we take all the beer away and we turn off the TV might have something to do with the darkness that happens with the caretakers? And Mr. Burns says, yes, I'll tell you what, Smithers. If we come back and everyone is slaughtered, I owe you a Coke.
I do.
I love that. That's.
Well, guys, as we wind this episode down here, and Kubrick, and I didn't know this, and I don't know how I didn't know this until right before this episode, but Kubrick's original ending to the film, a crucial scene was infamously deleted after the first week of previews in New York and L.A. In that cut of the film, the very first one that they put out, it takes place after the shot of Jack frozen and finds Wendy and Danny recovering from their experiences in the hospital. Stuart Ullman comes to visit the two to let them know that no evidence of the supernatural was found. Then in a haunting callback, Ullman tosses Danny that same yellow tennis ball that was rolled to him in the hallway. I just thought that was that would have been a pretty cool ending as well. Again, Kubrick going metaphorically. Okay, guys.
It's a cool ending, but you know what? I think Mike Flanagan's Dr. Sleep really was the perfect culmination. It was the perfect ending of The Shining. I think if you watch those two movies, and today was the first time I ever watched them back to back, to see those two movies together, I think really ties everything together that you were talking about, Wes. You know, I think it really ties the elements of everything in both movies. It ties them together perfectly.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for entertaining me tonight on one of my all-time favorite movies. It was great to really peel back all the layers of the onion and talk about a bunch of different things. And Dave, thank you so much for donating your time to us, stopping by Real Talk. And you were fantastic. You were so well prepared. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. And it was great to be here. I absolutely love this. I've talked about this movie ad nauseum on other podcasts, but this one is my favorite because I think we delved into it more deeply than I ever have before. And I loved it. So thank you very much for having me on.
Yes, sir. And we'll do it again sometime. Gabe, T-Man, any closing thoughts before I do our outro?
I like that T-Man was negative about it, and then we got to see Dave's deep love for it. I like the combination.
I wasn't that harsh on it, really.
Give us all your closing harsh thoughts.
I do have one final thing that I wanted to bring up, but I couldn't fit it in. And Wes, I know you mentioned it about Scatman Crothers, who, first of all, I love that name, and I know we didn't talk about him much, but he's really good. But just think about his last day. He flew all the way to Colorado and drove in that snowstorm. He didn't immediately get axed to death.
That's the only reason he showed up there. Yes.
And when Jack comes out, just yelling with that, that's a way to go out. Jack Nicholson just yelling at you.
Catman Crothers was excellent. He was. For me, you know, as much as I really did love Dr. Sleep, and I like the actor who played the character that Scatman Crothers played, Dick Halloran.
Well, audience, we hope you enjoyed our coverage of The Shining tonight. A couple of things we're going to ask you to do to support our efforts. A big thing you can help us do to grow our show is subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Anytime we release a new episode, it's going to download straight to your library and be waiting for you. If you get an opportunity, leave us a rating or review on that platform as well. We'd love to hear from you. Interacting with our listeners and friends has been probably the most rewarding and fun thing about podcasting. So you can follow us at Twitter at Real_cast. That's REEL. You can find us on Facebook, Real Talk, a movie podcast page. We have an Instagram page, Official Real Talk Podcast. And finally, we just want to thank everyone who downloads this show and for making it possible. And for us, that's a wrap.